This session is entitled, Has the Parish a Future? : The New Believers. And what we're going to be talking about really is some major changes that have already taken place in American organized religious life, and some of the alternatives that have already set in, some of the directions that have made themselves clear. And then I'll end, as I did yesterday, and it seemed to work out yesterday, well, it worked out well yesterday, with a series of specific questions and proposals for our consideration. And as we talked about yesterday, if some of the material at the beginning seems rather unduly abstract and vague, and I only have to repeat my apology that I made yesterday, that these are simply some of the gymnastics that academics go through, whirling and diving and twisting their way through long abstract kinds of things, and then we'll get to the main point rather quickly. And I put on the board here in black, I think it's easier than white, it's easier to read rather than the green and white here, some, especially two very, very good books, which back home, if you want to follow up on some of this, which has good empirical statistical evidence, you might find interesting, I think, especially for those who are interested in the problem of the decline or growth, really, of parish life, and what we might learn from the past on these. These were two books which were published by Pillars. I didn't put this on the sheet here, but these were published by the what's called the Pilgrim Press, which is the church press owned by the UCC, or the United Congregational Church. But they are they really discuss both the mainline and evangelical Protestant churches, and for further research, good, really good, solid stuff. Both of these books are good. Actually, the Dudley book is, in a sense, a popularization of the Hoag and Rosen sort of thing, and I would strongly recommend these for your parish library or for your, you know, for your own perusal with these. So it's not good to load, you know, load up with a long bibliography, because that simply destroys evidence. I mean, destroys interest with this. Okay. Now, very brief introduction, and then get into the problem, and then to go into some specifics as to what some of the solutions might be for this. As we all know, and we've looked at it for a long time, and it's been analyzed and analyzed over again, starting somewhere in the mid to the late 60s, the numerical, financial, and to some degree vital strength of many mainline Protestant denominations started to decline rather seriously, and this was not true. This was true not only for mainline denominations themselves, but what was happening was a decline of confidence among the American public in almost all of the major governing institutions. There developed a good deal of suspicion, a lack of confidence, lack of confidence in government, what government could do, what the colleges and universities could do, what the economy could or couldn't do, what the military could or couldn't do. The major institutions all underwent a severe decline in loyalty and respect on the part of large numbers of people. And they were seen as, the decline here was seen as a sign of weakness, or that something was seriously wrong, really, with America. And one problem, when we were looking for a scapegoat, was that in the 60s, as contrasted to the 50s, we couldn't blame, you know, foreign influences or alien influences for what was wrong in America. In the 1950s, I talked about this a little bit last week, for those who were here, need a reminder, like Larry. Larry needs lots of help with sometimes. He really does all the time. Right. Three syllable words for Larry. All right. Anyway, I'll get you for that moldy one yet. You know, I warned you. You know. Okay. All right. Anyway, that's an inside joke. But anyway, the idea was that America was failing. But in the 50s, we had been able to blame everything that was wrong in America on communists, or pro-communists, or lib-thinks, or all kinds of things, or pointy-headed professors, or parlor pinks, or things like this. You know, the whole thing. And in the 1960s, the problems we faced had really nothing to do with communism. The problems we faced had to do with internal problems: the problem of race, of racism, of sexism, of pollution, of the anti-war movement, the whole raft of problems that all of us are so familiar with at that time. All right, so. We're all familiar with this particular trend And what has happened is, and I want to zero in obviously today just on the parish, is that this trend really hasn't, it slowed down some, but it hasn't really been reversed at all. In fact, there are many serious students of parish life in America, including Douglas John Hall, who has a book with just about the same title in our library. This is the one who also has Light in Our Darkness, A Theology of the Cross, which is one of the basic sort of prerequisites for understanding what's going on at Holden. But Hall has a book and they argue, Hall with others, and some of the people in these books argue, that really by the year 2000, it may well be that the parish will be in such a numerical and financial minority as to have as much influence on American life as, let's say, and I don't say this sarcastically, as, let's say, the Kiwanis. That you won't really be able to distinguish, if you're Kiwanis, I don't mean that critically. I could say Rotary or Eastern Star or International Order of Odd Fellows or whatever voluntary association it might be. We're with this, all right. Now, and there is interesting evidence that the parish may well be in very serious decline by that particular time. Now, we can't really sort of settle that issue today because obviously that's a matter of for the future. But what we can do really are three things, and I want to sort of list the objectives here for what I have in mind for what we can do today. First of all, granted, and we can prove this statistically, that the mainline parishes are in a state of decline which really hasn't bottomed out yet, although it may be slowing down. You know, what are some of the wrong reasons given for the decline of parish vitality? A lot of the trouble is that people have made the wrong diagnosis as to why parish life has declined. And it's just like an MD, you can't come up with a good prognosis unless you've for the future unless you've got a good diagnosis of what went wrong in the past. And I'm going to go through three or four false or misleading explanations of what went wrong with parish life in the 60s and in the 70s. And secondly, we want to look at the fact that assuming that there has been a decline in vitality in different areas, look at who and where help for the parish might exist. Where might there be support? Where might there be resources? Where might we turn for an attempt at least to revitalize or keep the parish afloat through some rather difficult times ahead? And then see in the third part, this is where I'll go into some specific suggestions, see in the third part if we can work out some concrete proposals as to specifically what might be done. Maybe we don't want to do anything. Maybe we want to say that what the churches should do is put forward what they consider to be their best programs, offer what they consider to be their strengths, and if these people, which I call the new believers, aren't willing to join or adapt themselves to what the mainline or the evangelical denominations have to offer, then that's simply the way it's going to be. All right. So much for that. What I'm saying, let me go at it slightly differently. What I'm saying is that traditional parish life and commitment, such as we've known it, is in something of a state of decline. And that at the same time that that's taking place, there is not a decline really in people who are interested in the number of people and the enthusiasm of people who are interested in something that we might call religious commitment. It's that a growing number of people, those I call the new believers, are finding ways and means of expressing their commitment outside of the traditional boundaries of the organized parishes themselves with us. Now, let me first of all answer a question some of you may have right at this point. When I say that there is a decline of interest and involvement in the churches, you might say, well, aren't we in a time sort of a conservative resurgence? Aren't we in a time of sort of a return to basics, to conservative politics, for instance, as one evidence of this, of a more conservative trend in economics, even such things as a conservative trend in the way people dress, the preppy look, for instance, is contrasted to, I don't know what you want to call the look of the late 1960s and so on, and now as evidence of this, sort of thing. And how can one say then that there is a decline of interest or involvement in religion when there seems to be, when the pendulum seems to be swinging back more towards a conservative outlook in so many areas of our life? The answer to that is that in the mainline churches, there is definitely not a return or a swing of the pendulum back to a more conservative stance. And certainly there is not a visible pickup in the financial or numerical strength of the mainline churches themselves. And interestingly enough, and we don't have all the final conclusive statistics in on this right now, it seems fair to say that by 1980, the evangelical boom, the years of the evangelicals, are just about over. You remember in 19, was it Time or Newsweek, it doesn't matter, one of the two, made 1976 the year of the evangelical, big, big story. We had what I called the Carter-Colson-Cleaver syndrome, in which we had Jimmy Carter, Charles Colson, and Eldridge Cleaver all talking born-again Christianity in 1976. The big boom was one, and Bible colleges in places like Wheaton and Bethel, Gordon-Conwell, for instance, some of the more conservative seminaries and colleges across the country, and Christian day schools, which are still growing, but I think for reasons other than their theology with this. Even now, it seems as though besides the decline or the stabilization, let's put it that way, in the mainline churches, the same thing can be said with some qualifications for the evangelical churches themselves with this. And therefore, we have to look at the question of the future of the parish, not only as whether or not the mainline churches have a future, or whether the evangelical parishes have a future. Well, one more qualification or objection you might raise at this point, since I've been talking about it here, and that is, doesn't the resurgence or the boom of interest in the electronic preachers indicate that there are that there is a substantial interest in returning to the old time religion in America? And the answer I would give to that is, for the most part, no, because what I call the Big Four in the book, The Politics of Moralism, what the Big Four of the television preachers have found, and these Big Four would be Pat Robertson with 700 Club, Jim Baker with PTL, James Robeson of the Evangelistic Association, and Falwell, of course, probably the best known. What these have found is not a resurgence of interest or new interest in the old-time religion. They simply found out how to get the money from these people, from this, through direct mail computers, and I should have brought one along. I'm going to bring one along when I talk about creationism on Thursday, on how they reach people on direct mail computer outputs, and then also on the various programs such as the 700 Club or the PTL or the Old Time Gospel Hour on Sunday mornings, and so on that. So I don't think that, what I'm saying is that I don't think that the resurgence of the electronic preachers, these four that I've mentioned, and of course you could always mention the older generation, Rex Humbard, Oral Roberts, and Graham himself, indicates a new surge of interest in the old-time religion. It simply means that they're better organized and they found better ways in which to tap the resources and mobilize these people themselves. All right, so much for that. Any comment? I thought I saw a hand or two. Anything so far? Yes.
Are you going to characterize these new believers?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's part two.
How does the television affect our churches? Doesn't it affect them badly?
Yeah. Briefly, it depends. I mean, we don't have conclusive evidence because the electronic church people say that they have evidence that once people watch Pat Robertson or Jim Baker or any of those two especially, that they get more involved in church life. And on the other hand, when you think of the fact that the Big Four, Robeson, Falwell, Robertson, and Baker, had maybe at best a $100,000 to $200,000 a year income a few years ago, and now each are bringing in, with Robeson doesn't get quite as much, but the other three are bringing in over $1 million a week. That's a week, not, and Falwell's going to get over $60 million this year, calendar 80, for instance. Some of that money would have gone into the local parish. Some of that money would have gone to Bethel Lutheran out on Cedar and North Avenue in Northfield, for instance. And I've talked, some of you know, what's his name, Roald Kingdom, who's in charge of development in the ALC, and what he's upset about, and one reason he encouraged me to write the book on the electronic preachers, is that what he's found out in places like Lignite, North Dakota, that's a funny name, but there is Lignite in North Dakota, both ways, both as a town and as a mineral, is that people there, our ALC members, are sending money to 700 Club and PTL and not giving it to the ALC. So he encouraged, you know, that sort of thing. And there's a debate back and forth there, but there's also the possibility, and we can talk about this, that 700 Club and PTL might start their own denominations in the cities. That might be an interesting competition if any of you are pastors. For you with this, how do you compete with men in pink tuxedos and you know, Tammy Faye Baker caressing the microphone? Sure by comparison is innocuous. Sure is a pussycat. By comparison, I mean, that's my own personal feeling, and I'll state it so for the tape. With this, there's really, by comparison, to say the kind of politics that Jerry Falwell is preaching, Schuller's More Beautiful You sort of thing is so harmless as to, you know, virtually be, what was the, Jim was talking about this yesterday, just a tiny little pimple on the body. It really doesn't amount to much with this. The only problem with Schuller is that he said such, and this is true for a lot of parishes, that as a preacher, he is so smooth and so slick and everything else that a lot of people, and maybe some of you who are pastors can tell me this or say yes or no to this, set such a standard that people measure their own pastors against Schuller. And they come to Old Bethel Lutheran, and there isn't a bubbling fountain, and there aren't you know, natural flowers 12 months out of the year, and everything isn't in beautiful color and everything else. And in fact, at the churches that start at 10:30 in Northfield for their second service, Schuller ends at 10:30, and there is a decided gap because people wait until they get to see all of the Schuller show on channel, and then speed off to Trinity Lutheran or St. John's Lutheran or whatever the others might be. They've proved this beyond any question about that. Right. Thank you for that question. Okay. Now, so we've got a decline, but we don't have a sort of decline in interest. But we do have some wrong reasons, I think, why churches have been in decline in this country. And that's what I want to go into first, and then we'll get to the new believers, and then whether or not this group I call the new believers and those I call the traditional believers can find some common ground on this. All right. First of all, for the wrong reasons for why there has been church decline in this country. Some specialists and some students said, for instance, in the 60s and the 70s, that one major reason that was that Americans were becoming too wealthy. They were becoming too rich. They were becoming too involved with leisure time. Since they had more time and more, I mean, they had more money to spend for leisure time, with all that, they would simply get in their old Winnebago and off they would go on Friday night and not come back till Sunday night or Monday morning. And Winnebago or whatever other recreational vehicle, RV, that you have, we have RV. I have to put in a plug for Winnebagos because my sister has stock on the company. So anyway, and there are lots of others. With this, but you know what I mean. With this, Americans were too devoted to leisure time. The answer to that is that leisure opportunities long predated the decline in membership and in financial support for the churches. There were all kinds of opportunities away for getting away from home, getting away from the local parish, long before the decline in the 1970s set in. In fact, the real decline set in the 1920s when Americans got their first automobiles and they could get away from Eureka, South Dakota for a weekend. And this showed up rather clearly in church involvement in the 1920s, but not the 1970s. So the fact that the wealth increased in the 60s and the 70s is really sort of a false reason to explain the decline in church vigor. Okay. A second one would be, in a sense, the opposite argument. The argument of overwork, that people were too busy making money, too involved in their own lives, too involved in their work, too involved in community activities, their families, whatever it might be, and didn't have time left over for church activities. And people pointed to the fact, for instance, that there were many more women in the labor market in the late 1960s and the 1970s, which meant that for some families, the only day in which the whole family could be together for activities would be Sunday. And that there were those who were marginal church people at best who didn't want to use that time for church activity, but would rather, you know, get out wherever it might be on this sort of thing. All right. Now, there's no question in, that there were some drastic changes that took place because more women were in the market, or in the job market in the 1960s and the 1970s than had been the case before. But when you look, for instance, as the authors I have on the board here do, at the membership statistics, what you find that you find is that the percentage of working women represented in churches is roughly the same as the population as a whole, that there is no significant correlation between the fact that there were more women working full-time or part-time in the 70s and decline in church vigor and church enthusiasm at that particular time. There's just no statistical correlation there at all. All right. So those too much leisure time, too much work are two sort of erroneous reasons as to why there was a decline. A third one, which goes a little bit deeper than these two, would be the impact of public events in the 1960s especially. And I want to go into this in a little bit detail, and if it isn't clear, by all means, you know, keep after me until it is. All right. Why do I say this? Because in the 1950s, by way of contrast, America was involved in what we call the Cold War. And one of the ways in which we were told by, you know, our church leaders, our religious leaders, Eisenhower, for instance, and so many others, Norman Vincent Peale would be another one, a strong leader in the 50s. One way we were told we could resist communism was to get involved and be active church members. That we were involved in a spiritual contest, not just an economic or a political or a diplomatic contest with a demonic force. And therefore, we have in the 50s, and we can document this beyond any question, look at, you know, the statistics in the yearbook of American churches, which the NCC puts out, we have growing increase in church attendance and church enrollment membership and church financial support in the 50s, to where it reached its peak in 1958 of 64% of all Americans attended church at least once a week. And it's, you know, it's gone down since then, and it's coming back a little bit now. But the one major factor was Americans believed that there was a necessity for getting involved with church life as one means of resisting communism. But that sort of faded, as I talked about before, in the 1960s. In the 1960s, churches were faced with some very, very difficult choices. Two especially, whether or not to get involved in the anti-war movement, whether or not, or to the extent to which they should get involved in the civil rights movement, as two specific examples of this. All right. And since it was impossible to sort of take a compromising or middle-of-the-road stand, some people will say that churches lost members, churches lost contributors and all the rest because they took a pro-war or an anti-war stand in that period, and hence people dropped out. The argument was put forward because they didn't like the way the church stood on this. And I've heard pastors, for instance, here tell me that they lost financial contributions directly after they themselves, the ministers, had delivered, let's say, an anti-war sermon. With this, the same thing can be said for the civil rights movement. That some people didn't like what the churches were saying, or some church people were saying about the civil rights movement in the 60s, and therefore they simply dropped out with this. All right. Now, the possibility that the events of the 1960s helped contribute to church decline sounds good on the surface, but it, again, like the other things with too much work or too much leisure, can't really be documented decisively by the statistics. But what we know did happen, and this is really sort of the transition into the second part here that I want to talk about, what did happen was that, as I mentioned at the very beginning, there was a decided decline of respect for and trust in the institutions of the country itself, including the church. The government, the economy, the military, the schools, all underwent this crisis of confidence. For instance, there was a decline in involvement in other voluntary associations, scouts, for instance, social lodges, farm co-ops, PTAs, all had drop-offs in memberships. Americans started doubting the authority of their institutions. And they found that their older traditional voluntary associations and institutions simply weren't doing the job. All right. But what happened, and this is the transition here, what happened was that this didn't mean, for our purposes here in talking about organized religion, this didn't mean that they became suddenly agnostic or atheistic or lost a sort of a sense of the importance of religious faith for their life. What happened, and Martin Marty has a fine essay on this, and he documents this as happening about 1968 or 1969, is that for a large number of people, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the black liberation movement, the anti-war movement, the student movement, gave them a broader or at least a different sense of what it meant to be religious. That's really the transitional sentence here, or the swing sentence, whatever you know metaphor you want to use, that I want to talk about here today. The various kinds of protest and reform movements in the 60s convinced a large number of people that they did not necessarily have to be members of an organized, institutionalized religious community in order to be able to express their religious and their moral convictions with this. They found, for instance, that the churches oftentimes were very slow to get involved in some of the more significant movements itself, and found that their lives were drastically changing and that the churches were caught in what we call culture lag. The churches really weren't keeping up with this sort of thing. Some people became instantly radicalized. If you watch, some of you will remember the 1968 Democratic National Convention, and it was hard to believe in the integrity and the, how should I say this, and maintain respect for, let's say, the police force in Chicago after you watched the 1968 Democratic Convention with this. Or, you know, all kinds of examples. I'm sure you all have your examples of from your own lives of what happened in the 1960s. All right, now, out of this change for a lot of people came one crucial conclusion. The church involvement did no longer seem as important as it once was with this. Church involvement no longer seemed as important as it once did. Religion, instead of being expressed, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, this is what we can discuss, but you know, this is what's happening, and we have to look at it carefully. When you look at the statistics like United Methodist Church losing over 2 million members, for instance, you know, you sort of wake up. LCA lost 500,000 people at one point with this, and you know, others, you can go right down the line. What happened was that religious faith became a matter of personally integrating and interpreting life's experiences. And if you look at the chart, a very simple thing that I have here, what happens is that people still, those I call, we'll call the new believers, still had profound religious experiences. And the profound religious experiences led them to a new sort of sense of believing. But in contrast to earlier periods in American history, the believing did not necessarily lead to the third step of belonging to a denomination. You see what I'm trying to say? First of all, the experience of as for instance, a friend of mine went out one day in it's a part of the University of Minnesota called Dinkytown, and she went out to have lunch, and there was an anti-war demonstration about three blocks beyond, and all she wanted was lunch, and thought that, you know, it was perfectly safe to go out and have lunch. And what was happening was that the police and National Guard and others decided that they weren't going to allow this anti-war demonstration at the University Armory, so they came and dropped tear gas over the all of Dinkytown, and she got gassed simply for her efforts of going out, and she decided, this is the way to solve problems. You know, can't even go out and have a decent lunch without getting gassed. So she became, in a sense, radicalized or turned off as to some basic institutions that were going on at that time. All right. So what I'm trying to say here is that people didn't lose their strong sense of religious conviction. Their experiences told them that indeed some sort of religious faith, such as it was, and I'll define it in a little while, was necessary. This led to a renewed dedication or you know, sets of beliefs, but it didn't necessarily lead to the third step, and that is of joining or belonging. Hence the decline sets in with us. All right. So far, okay? Okay. You know, part two here. What we have and what these books show so clearly is a large and growing number of people that these particular experts call the new believers, for want of an easier or a more complicated term. What we have in American society are a large number of new believers. Some are dropouts. from the denominations. You know, as I said, some didn't like what the, if the minister had been pro-civil rights, so some would have dropped out. And some, if the minister had been anti-civil rights, some would have dropped out. You know, you can't please all the people all the time with this. So it really goes much more deeper than that. What we have are a growing number of people, especially in their 20s and now in their 30s, who really looked over this, you know, the situation and decided that the organized church did not really offer them the most meaningful outlet for the religious faith and commitments which they believed were so important for themselves. In other words, they reached this conclusion that religious faith is not synonymous with church membership. That's sort of really an anchor sort of statement here, that religious faith is not synonymous with church membership, which is in contrast to many of the convictions that existed before with this. In other words, churches and synagogues had lost their franchise or their monopoly, you see, on religion. A growing number of people, those I call the new believers, have had meaningful and continuing relationships with God, and have had these without the benefit of going through the organized churches themselves with this. And what seems especially interesting is that as these scholars have interviewed what we call the new believers, their faith is not really that far out or different from what we would call mainline or major traditional religious convictions. That these aren't just a small number of Zens, for instance. People get all excited because they suddenly find some people getting into Zen Buddhism. It turns out, you know, maybe there are 5,000 in the whole country of 220 million, but it makes good copy and for colorful pictures on the Sunday rotogravure and so on. And so it becomes a media event with this. Or suddenly you find, you know, 20 Hare Krishna marching down Broadway with their cymbals and their drums and everything else, and people say the youth are all becoming Hare Krishna. And it's such a small number as to be almost infinitesimal, but they catch your attention. Or if you're at the airport and the Moonies are soliciting, you know, for give you a flower and so on, people get excited. The youth are going to Eastern cult. And there's at best, the most generous estimate is that there are 30,000 Moonies in the country. 30,000. And maybe that's 30,000 too many for some of you. You know, it's again a media event with us. All right. Now, in other words, so we have a group of new believers in this country. The question then is, what do the new believers really believe, and is there common ground between the existing denominations and the new believers so that the new believers might be the source to reinvigorate the life of the parish again? I think it's evident that this group, the experts call the new believers, are not going to move directly into the churches as we know them today. First of all, what do they believe? And secondly, is there any hope that there might be some common ground over what the traditional and the new believers themselves have expressed as their deepest religious convictions? First of all, let's look then at what the new believers believe. And I think there is really, in a sense, a growing number, a significant body of people out there who simply don't come to church but who are, quote, religious or have strong religious convictions. First of all, as the little chart here suggests, they believe very strongly in the primacy, the absolute autonomy of personal religious experience. The first thing, of personal religious experience. So this is a personal, not a corporate kind of religious commitment that they're involved with. Personal experience is paramount with them. They have had something happen in their lives, some sort of experience in their lives, which has been not necessarily what we would call in evangelical terms, you know, a born-again experience, but something has happened to them. They've been touched by the anti-war movement. They've been touched by the draft. They've been touched by the women's movement or by the Black Liberation Movement or the Native American movement or the ecology movement or any number of these sort of things, or a combination of them. You have to say that also with this. And suddenly their lives are different because of this, a turnaround that's taken place. And you can, you know, document this all over the place with this. All right. And this kind of experience with one or more of these causes that I've just mentioned here convinces them that there is indeed a transcendent or a supernatural reference or force at work in life, that they aren't interested in any of these reform movements that I've talked about simply because it would make life more pleasant or more just or anything else. But they find in something like the anti-war movement or the ecology movement or any of the others that I mentioned here, a transcendent reference or a force at work which is, according to Dudley here, which is grounded in the belief of a supreme being, which is the beginning really of religious faith. And it, their religious convictions are expressed through human rather, are expressed through secular rather than through ecclesiastical or church sources. They find that they can express their convictions through reform movements, through getting involved in society rather than going through the churches as a way of doing this. And the aim of all of their efforts, all of their reform movements, and all the rest, are to create loving, permanent loving relationships. This is really what the ultimate aim is, and they think that this really can be done. So they have a commitment to a transcendent order, a belief in a personal God. This can be expressed in involvement through secular rather than church-related organizations, creating a situation where permanent loving institutions can or relationships can be created with this. Now, a second characteristic besides personal religious experience is something which we would call a very profound but oftentimes inarticulate mystical faith. That is to say that they are not at all convinced that there is that the Judeo-Christian tradition itself offers the only sort of direct pipeline, if you want to put it that way, or avenue to understanding what God's activities in this world are all about. There are many different ways to understand what God is doing in the universe, and according to the New Believers, and they are willing to be very eclectic or to be very flexible. There are different verbs you can use here. Flexible in understanding how this might be done. God might take on, for instance, the face of a Buddha. God might be known in the flicker of a meditation candle. God might be seen or understood in the body of Christ on the cross. It could be in a wide variety of experiences, and they refuse to be sort of judgmental on what for what's good for one group has to be really good for another. With this. And thirdly, I think that they feel that in their quest for permanent loving relationships, they no longer are dependent, as many people in the traditional churches are, for an institution such as a church to provide means, such as we would call the means of grace, for forgiveness from sins. They are not at all convinced that the traditional Christian teaching of what we would call original sin, whatever you want to call it, is really what is at fault with society and with our individual lives itself. They are not convinced, and as I say, this is I'm simply going at what the researchers say here. They are not at all convinced that the reason we haven't achieved the kind of just society which we can achieve is due to what traditional Christian teachings has labeled as original sin. Rather, instead, they would argue from what they would consider to be a more constructive or optimistic position that what is necessary is creation of institutions which will allow for loving, personal, immediate kinds of relationships to flourish. And to come to the conclusion here, what they don't find for all practical purposes is this taking is this sort of happening in the organized churches. All right. So to sum up on this point, new believers base their faith in their own personal experience. They cannot plug into mainline churches which claim identification with a religious tradition which is older, which is rooted in tradition, which goes back, if not to the Reformation for many people, back even further for, let's say, Roman Catholics or for Orthodox or capital O or Orthodox people themselves. They simply find that this may be interesting historically, but it's not necessarily something that should shape and define what they believe today. Just because somebody like John Calvin or John Knox or Martin Luther or Zwingli or somebody else like this defined this situation at that time. All right. Now the question becomes, and here's where we get to the sort of the third part and the practical point. To come back to my original premise, since it is true that there is a continuing, if diminishing, decline of involvement by Americans in the traditional communities of faith or the organized churches, and there is this large body of, quote, new believers out there who have strong religious commitments but who do not find the organized churches, the most constructive channels in which these can be expressed, then, you know, what should we do? What should we do? What kind of questions should we ask as to what really should be done with this? For one, and I have a special interest in this because of my own research with this, it would seem that the organized churches would have common ground with the, quote, new believers in effectively opposing some of the more reactionary religious movements that are taking place at this time, such as that which can be called the new religious right, more specifically things like the moral majority. There are opportunities here for a kind of a common witness, I think, where people can find at least what they don't like is going on, and perhaps in joining together with different groups, some more positive witness can be made there. Or in looking for the looking for ways in which new believers and traditional believers can be brought together, according to Dudley here, church leaders should think through very carefully a couple of startling but documentable statistics. For instance, we live in an age in which we pride ourselves on our flexibility and our tolerance and our generosity towards other commitments of faith and so on. But it can be proven statistically here that when you have interfaith marriages that take place, there is usually a greatly reduced participation in the church life by one or sometimes both spouses as a result of this. That is a very controversial kind of point, but nevertheless it oftentimes happens. And what Dudley and the others have found is that sometimes new believers have come or have sort of joined in the ranks of this movement I call the new believers because the interfaith marriage itself has not worked out where a solution for the question of what to do when two religious traditions clash in a marriage has occurred with us. All right. Or another feature in talking about what can be done in seeing if we can get new believers and traditional believers together and revitalize the church. When programs for churches are being planned, leaders at all levels should recognize, according to Dudley and Hogan and the others, that the church programs which show the most vitality, which show the most support, or which garner the most support, are programs which are centered on family, which are centered on ethnic loyalty, and which are centered on the local community. Those three are worth repeating. The church programs that have, by evidences of membership, financial support, and participation and all the rest, the church programs that work the most successfully in those terms are those which concentrate on family, which concentrate on ethnic loyalties, and which concentrate on local community loyalties themselves. And where new believers, put it another way, new believers themselves seem to be more cosmopolitan, more sophisticated in their general outlook than maintaining some of the older traditional loyalties to immediate family loyalties, to immediate ethnic loyalties, to immediate community loyalties with this. And is what they are, the specialists here are suggesting, is there some way in which this sort of this gap can be bridged? Or should we continue along the older traditional lines of maintaining programs which are loyal, which uphold specifically the emphasis on the nuclear family, the emphasis on ethnic loyalties, and the emphasis on identification of the local congregation with also, you know, the local the community itself. Now, on a more positive note, and then I'll just have two or three of these, then we can stop for discussion here. It's clear in those programs which seem to have succeeded better than the others that the people who are satisfied with their churches and with their pastor will have a much higher level of participation, which may be a truism, but nevertheless it's something that's worth considering. And the question, of course, becomes how do you increase that? If you want to reach out and bridge the gap that I've talked about here, how can the denominations, and still maintain their loyalty to their own traditions, how can they increase the level of satisfaction with the church programs and with the pastors themselves? And finally, with this, the churches that seem to have succeeded the best, and they can be evangelical, they can be mainline, they can be Catholic, they can be what we would call in a sect, such as Jehovah's Witness or Seventh-day Adventist and all the rest, across the boards, one clear theme stands out above all the others. The more that persons feel accepted, the more they feel loved, the more they feel supported by the church, their greater will be their participation in the church, unquestionably, you know, across the line, and regardless of denominational label itself. The more they feel accepted, the more they feel loved, the more they feel supported, the greater their participation in the church will be with us. This point came through in the statistics that I've used from this book, these books, time and time again. The most frequently mentioned reason list on the lists that the researcher sent out was of the new believers was that they failed to feel that they were accepted, loved, or wanted. They perceived the churches to be too rigid, too narrow, the traditional members to be less tolerant and less accepting of a diversity of viewpoints than the new believers themselves. And hence, what we have, and this I'll stop with this, is a situation where the traditional church faces at best an uncertain future, whereas paradoxically at the same time there are a substantial number, and I think an increasing number of people who have not in a sense given up or retreated from a sense of religious commitment, but are simply finding or looking for alternative ways in which, you know, this can be expressed. And so I've talked a little too long. But we've got at least a half an hour for comments, discussion. Well, I didn't give an answer. I mean, should the churches consciously alter or revamp their programs to, in a sense, soften, let's say, the Lutheran or the Methodist or the capital O Orthodox quality to their program or characteristics of their program, in order to reach out to these people we call the new believers? That would be one place.
Or can they?
Well, they can. I mean, you know, theoretically you can. I mean, you don't have to call yourself Trinity Lutheran. You can just call yourself Grace Community Church or like this, where you remove the denominational edge.
Well, that's theoretically possible, yeah. But how many Lutheran churches would decide to, let's call ourselves the community church and drop the Lutheran? I mean, there would be a debate for years, and that would never be resolved. It would be resolved, I guess, if this was very serious discussion by some people leaving Trinity Lutheran and forming the community church.
I contribute to Trinity Lutheran Church. And I also contributed to Billy Graham. Am I wrong?
No. Billy Graham's group is not would not be in the group I call the New Believers. With this, Graham would be a parachurch, what we would call a parachurch or a para-ecclesiastical, being alongside parallel or para organization.
Done, but the Bible says, going to all the nations.
Yeah, he's more people have seen Billy Graham than any other religious leader in, you know, the history of the world. That's true. With this, so I'm not talking about Graham. I'm talking about those. No, not the new believers type that I've outlined, Larry.
You have spoken, and I trusted the books too as well. I have not read them about these new believers outside of the church. The question is whether the characteristics of the new believers doesn't also pertain for some of those who are already church members. And then that has some implications for the question of whether there are grounds, common grounds there. Peter Berger, in the book The Heretical Imperative, says that a characteristic of our time is that we're not simply, it isn't as though as it was in the 50s where you had a clear-cut religious belief identified with institutions on the one hand and a kind of secular ethos and experience on the other hand. Mm-hmm. What has happened now is you have moved from secularization to pluralism. Mm-hmm. And the pluralism shows up in just exactly what you described, a wide variety of religious experience, some sense of the transcendent, being moved, being touched, some sense of another reality than the one simply what you see in front of your eyes that one participates in, and whether it's the groups that you mentioned or whatever, the women's movement, environmental movement, civil rights, whatever. And I just speculate that a number of those folks are in the church who have also sense that. They may not be totally comfortable there.
So
what we ought to do perhaps is to check that out within the membership itself and then see if you haven't got the already in your own ranks the connections with those outside the church. I think we do.
You think there's more of a connection that I've suggested here?
I think that description of the new believers is that when you start identifying the marks there, that's a kind of cultural phenomenon or has a cultural wide expression. And it just raises the question then of whether that doesn't also pertain for those in the church.
Are you saying that one way to define a new believer is to define the deadwood in your own congregation?
Well, I don't know if I call everybody else dead wood. But it's just not to locate that experience of the new believers only outside the church. I think that is something that has affected a lot of people,
yep,
wherever they are, in or out.
Okay.
Well, we feel that we keep diluting ourselves by trying to embrace everything there. That's my worry.
Yeah, I was going to press that one. Let's put that on the back burner for a minute and see if you have the same kind of question, then we can come to it if we do.
Well, I was just going to mentioning, you know, the dead wood of the church, possibly. Depends on which perspective the situation is looked at. Possibly some of the new believers might possibly, under this type of thinking, could look at the people in the church as the dead wood.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on how you look.
I think that's more true. I don't think it's so much that the new believers, well, I just think that maybe the new believers are turned off by what they see the witness of the church as, or the lack of witness. I think that it's more that the church isn't true to its calling, and they don't find anything authentic there, or not authentic enough to measure up to this other religious experience that they've had outside the church.
Comments on that? Yeah.
From what you described, kind of the marks of the new believer, the personal experience, the mystical, and the view of original sin, it seems to me that what might be being forged there, put it there, is a kind of a new linkage between personal faith and personal relationships and understanding of the corporate nature of life, which might be really tremendously fertile ground and helpful to the church, to Lord, as we, you know, proceed to explore what it means to be Christians in our age. And it seems to me those things are not necessarily dilutions at all. You know, there's certainly dangers in them, but if they can help us understand that you can have a personal faith relationship with God and have a basic commitment to enhancement of personal loving relationships with others. And that can be understood also in a very, in a corporate social sense. In fact, leads you into a new appreciation of the corporate dimension of life. And we've talked about, it seems to me we talk about they're not dependent on the church to provide means for forgiveness of sins. not convinced that original sin is at bottom the problem of an unjust society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that another way of saying that is that maybe their understanding of sin is more social.
Yes.
First of all, then it is individual or private. And it seems to me that is the, that is a emphasis that we are embedding.
That's an old traditional theological question that that goes back a long ways. Yes, did you?
Yeah, I have a little bit of difficulty with the definition of the new believer.
Okay.
If the new believer is heading in the right direction, then I think that the churches need to try very hard to incorporate them, to bring them to a real working knowledge of Christianity and commitment to Christ. For myself, I feel like my church is losing me because I'm not sure whether I'm a new a new believer or not. I've been in the church since I was born, but I made a renewed my commitment to Christ about 10 years ago. But the church, the Lutheran Church, is not meeting my needs at this moment, and I'm going to other churches.
For some of the reasons that I've mentioned here that the new believers find?
For a more spiritual experience, for friendship, for acceptance, for humanness, and cutting off the mask. Being real people.
I saw a nod back there. Remember, I heard John the first hour talk about if he sees a nod, he's going to call on you. So.
I think I like what you're saying. I'd like to believe that all the people exist. I'm a little bothered by it. It seems to quickly pass over a discount of the experience. Like this woman talking about.
No, I'm taking it very seriously. I didn't mean. I thought you were going to second it or disagree with it, or I think what you say is very, very important. And let me try a different metaphor of sieves, S-I-E-V-E-S. How narrow do we want the sieves when we put people in? Do we want the sieve in a sense so wide that lots of people can come into the church and feel at home and find the needs met that you're talking about there? Or do we want to narrow the size of the sieve so that by the time the mass, so to speak, gets down to the bottom, that it's separated out and there are fewer number of people there whose needs are met, but that there are a lot of number of people who are still on top, so to speak, of the sieve. Does that metaphor make any sense?
Somebody could do. You could declare that they're a member of the universal church of everybody living on the earth,
yeah.
And everyone's automatically a member. That includes everybody.
Yes, that'd be a pretty broad sieve.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. With this.
I feel like she does. I haven't gone to other churches yet, a little visiting, but then is it me that's not pouring forth the love and the warmth to get our church to feel loving and warm? So I can't just point to the church without pointing to myself. And this is where I am. I'm not quite as far as she is yet, but I feel this.
Well, the church, the new believers, I think a lot of thinking that the church is not the building and the structure. You know, we're all Christians are part of the church. And I think that that's part of what a lot of people are thinking nowadays. It isn't necessarily condemning individual organizations, I don't believe.
Within our church, we have people who are very warm and loving to each other, and we have a sense of communion with us, and we try to extend that, you know, as we can. Do you think we feel that with us?
Yes.
Well, I'm just wondering if part of your feeling that the church is losing you has to do with the fact that we're so loath to let the word be the living word, like John Schramm was talking about this morning, that we're really comfortable with letting it be dead word and wanting to keep it propositional truth and so on, and that we cling to that and we don't let the other thing happen. And people on the outside, too, I think, sense that, perhaps intuitively. And it's also saps life from those of us who are in the church, too. And that's part of the reason for the decline.
I guess I have kind of two reactions. First of all, in terms of new believers, I have problems with that definition. Because there are days when I feel like a new believer. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times if we are encountering the living word, we've become a new believer quite often. And
new every morning. Yeah.
New every morning. If we're growing, if we're staying open to new things, we become new believers every day. There are times when I feel like an old believer and I don't grow, but very oftentimes I feel like I'm a very new believer. So I think it was in the church we've got that. And also I think in terms of finding for these new believers that are outside the church, I think oftentimes we ourselves and other people have misunderstood what Lutheranism is about. We stand on grace and it's love and acceptance, and if we really proclaim that and accept other people and live it out, it can really be a beautiful place, and a place where these new believers who are looking for that type of an atmosphere could really find a place where they are very comfortable.
If any of you come from congregations where this sort of thing seems to be the accepted, obviously because there are some who have come from congregations where you feel turned off from this, we find ways in which this is being expressed and understood by the congregations.
Here at Holden.
Here at Holden, right? One, you know, can share some things from the local congregations which might help some of the rest of us when we don't find this. Jim?
I'm just a little confused with the definition of the new believer still. I'm involved with an Olympia. I'm involved with an Olympia. It has some things that are attractive to people, that marriage encounter type things that seem to make people feel accepted and loved. And it seems very navel-gazy-ish in a lot of ways. It makes people feel good, but I'm not real sure that there's a very strong Christian ethic involved.
Larry, we have a different viewpoint. The implication, yeah, Larry.
I think we've lost something in your first point in the definition, though. Namely, the personal experience of a transcendent reality. It wasn't simply feeling accepted and wanted and loved and warm.
It's not just warm fuzzies.
And that's what she said. Yeah. She included, among other things, a spiritual experience.
Yeah, very much so.
That was part of it. So that ought not to be lost in our discussion, because we're talking about folks who have already come with a strong sense of the transcendent or the holy or the sacred.
And don't quite know how, if at all, they want to have that expressed and nurtured through formal institutional means. Yeah.
Can I ask something of you, Erling, as a historian? At least in sociology of religion, one, and this is very broadly speaking, sees a pattern. The pattern is that a particular age is characterized by vivid religious experience, and it kind of goes where it wills. I mean, the spirit of Pentecost, the spirit blows where it wills. All sorts of people experience the transcendent, the holy.
Right.
It oftentimes then, because it's such a widespread and vivid experience, gives rise to religious institutions.
Yes.
Then the pattern is that they institutionalize it, forge it into traditions which they hand down.
Right.
What they'd hand down is the tradition rather than the experience.
Exactly. Yeah, this.
And then something else comes along, and then you experience another age in which is the experience then.
Yeah.
But that happens now outside of those institutions, because they've been handing down the experience as traditions, as ways of life, as liturgies, as rituals, as catechism. You know, and so that's the kind of pattern. What I think we're in the midst of now, whether it's here or in Islam or where, is a time of vivid religious experience, but the creaks and the beams are in the institutions which have depended upon the passing down of traditions rather than experience. You can't pass down experience.
No.
You hope that the traditions evoke or create.
This isn't a law or anything, but I don't want to sound academic here, but just briefly, this is H. Richard Niebuhr's whole thesis and what he was blamed for throughout his academic career. He taught at Yale Divinity for a long time, that somehow, suddenly, it could be a new pastor, or it could be a new revivalist, it could be a movement like the abolitionist movement or the women's movement, whatever it is, comes along and people see faith in a new way, a way in which they can express it in a new way. When much of the human potential movement in the 1960s suddenly opened up or freed up ways in which this could be expressed in ways which you would never have found in the 1950s. So we seek to incorporate that, and we want to make this more vivid and alive and real and meaningful in our organized religious institutions. And when this happens, or we might get a new denomination, and Joseph's best example would be the Mormons. Joseph Smith suddenly had a new vision. And it was a creative, exciting kind of time. And then what happens is that once that is put into institutionalized form, it becomes far more rigid and structured, and it's much more difficult to keep open and sensitive to new input, to new understanding and expressions. And institutional churches become more preoccupied with preserving what they have rather than reaching out. And what new believers, I think, are calling on is for churches to become more open, such as you're suggesting here, than to preserving some institution or some emphases or priorities simply because they come from the past.
I'm just going to give one far out example because I think it's a proper cultural reading. Matthew Fox, in the book A Spirituality Named Compassion, which is kind of a theme book for the summer, talks about in his travels as a Benedictine monk, very interested in what's happening in science and how scientists see the world. He gave a talk one time on mysticism, and he was talking to a group of scientists about mysticism. And he mentioned in the course of that he had a friend who was a physicist who was also a mystic. And after his talk, three of the physics teachers came up to it and said, you know what, I'm in physics for the mysticism of it. That for them was a religious experience. Now, they weren't in church for the mysticism of it.
What were they in church for?
Well, they weren't in church. But that's where you think they where they might have been.
Yeah.
Or should have been, but the church didn't offer the mystical dimensions of that they had experienced elsewhere. They were, I think, new believers by your definition.
Yeah, by my definition. Actually, it's Dudley's definition. I was using it here. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say it seems like a problem of kind of what you're talking about. I think it's over the years, Catholicism, all of the Protestant churches and so forth have developed baggage that they continually. Individual congregations, that the church structure becomes part of the baggage and the tradition and so on. And eventually it gets to be too much and too difficult to carry or something, and then we tend to go off in a little different direction. We tend to question, why do we put up with it, the baggage?
Yeah. What do you think of this idea one reason that churches congregations have maintained their vitality is that they have continued to emphasize loyalty to ethnic and local community priorities rather than reaching out? And if so, is that something which has inhibited a wider outreach or something that should be continued? Yeah.
I'm not sure I really agree with that because from what I've seen, churches that seem to be the most popular and the most growing are the ones that really emphasize the personal experience with Christ.
In a more warm kind of way, which don't emphasize.
And that reaches out to community because the closer relationship with Christ brings forth a wanting to do things for other people, and that brings in your community. Actually, it probably brings in your ethnic people and your family people. Centers in on the family. Your biblically oriented church.
Have others found the same trend that she's mentioning here?
Well, I think our little church flourishes because most of the people that come there come with the idea of what they can give and not what they can get.
How do you think that happened in the church?
Strangers coming to our church mention that it's a loving atmosphere, that everyone feels that they'd like to give something, and of course in their giving they get a great deal, because you can't give without getting. And I just feel that they have the spirit of wanting to help others, of wanting to give to the church. We support missions very well, and our seminary appeal goes over very well, because people feel this need of wanting to give.
Sometimes the need is not just that to be loved or wanted or accepted, but there is a need to be needed, a need to serve, a need to be active in ministry. And sometimes there seems to be a closed door for that, but it's done by other people, and we don't need you.
Is it that, when this doesn't happen, I mean, in contrast to what you're saying, is it that we expect too much from the churches? For instance, that the churches really aren't, in a sense, capable of being more than what the people are themselves?
I don't think you can expect too much. And you can't outdo God. The more you give, the more God gives to you.
If we raise the expectations, I mean, for congregations where, you know, there has been some difficulty and where you're not, is it that the expectations have been sort of what the membership in the church be, have they been, in a sense, presented in too demanding a fashion or misguided a fashion? Is that what you find? Yeah.
I kind of feel that in our country, there's a large group of people who the expectation when there's some problem or something wrong is they should do something about it. You watch the evening news and they're interviewing some unemployed worker someplace, and well, things are really tough, they should do something about this. And a good share of our country has the expectation that this mythical they or whatever is government or some organization or something should do something about it. And I'm sure that does not typify this lady over here's congregation and the people who belong to it. They feel like, you know, if something needs to be done, we should do something about it. It's the we versus the they. And I guess the example I would use is had an individual in our congregation who, you know, kind of blew up and got mad, and nobody ever asked him to do anything. And my response to him was, when you go home at night and see a weed growing in your flower bed in front of your house, do you wait for somebody to ask you to pull the weed? And I think it's which kind of person are you? Are you the kind of person who waits to be asked to do something, or is it the person who sees it needs to be pulled and pulled? And if you have a group of people and attract other people who are the kind who will pull the weeds in their own front yard, I think you'll have the kind of congregation this lady over here mentioned that she has.
And might be able to make more of a bridge through the gap of what I've been talking about here.
Rather than that kind of person who says they should do something about this terrible problem.
In terms of possible positive steps,
yeah.
Possibly we could go back to our congregations and look at expanding or developing lay ministry programs where we facilitate that type of thing, because it just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we just expect it to happen, it isn't going to happen.
They have to be concrete steps. Can you give one example in our congregation where with the lay ministry, I'm glad you mentioned it, it just jogged my memory. Rather than the minister being the answer person for everything and counseling on everything, you know, from A to Z, they have developed teams, so to speak, sometimes couples where that's the case, or whatever else, to act as whatever you want to call it, liaisons. For instance, with couples who are having marital discord, there are two couples in our church who went almost to the brink of divorce, but were able to forestall it, and they are the ones to whom you know, people with problems go. The same thing is true with financial difficulties. They can't do it. So when an attorney who's especially good in financial counseling is there, and who's available. And the people find that they are, it's much easier to talk with a lay person than it is sometimes with a minister on some of these things. And I think there's a couple, I'm trying to think of a couple other examples, but that I think gives a point. And that's worked out very well, even made the Lutheran standard.
I was going to say that I think for many congregations, the goals are too low.
Too low.
Too low. And I think you really have to hit high. There's an old passage, I mean, a little phrase that I've used so often is expect great things of God, but attempt great things for God. And I'm convinced that the only way a congregation can stay alive is to give itself away. All that you've got in your cold, dead hand is that which you've given away.
Our church has a strong committee structure, and we expect our committees to find experimental ways of doing things. And sometimes on the council, I feel there's kind of a feeling of holding off and not letting the committees do what they think is experimental. And yet I think as we look to see the enthusiasm of the committee for their project spread, that's a good feeling.
Yes.
I come from a large congregation in Trinity where Pastor Whitty is pastor. And of course, I don't admit that there's anything wrong with our church. I think it's a model. But we are large, and there is a problem of finding people that want to serve. For example, in our refugee program, we thought, where are we going to get all this help? Who's going to do it? And when we started asking, we found there were people who were not volunteering, but they had many gifts. And when we finally found them, they were great things they could do.
To plug into what he said, did you have to ask them to weed the garden, so to speak?
Right.
They didn't come forward?
No, they didn't.
That might be something for all of us to take home. I think one of the events, it's 12 o'clock, and one of the real strengths of Holden is the opportunity, for people from different parishes and from different parts of the country and different denominations and all the rest to share with this. For one, you feel find you're not alone, and secondly, you can find, some very concrete things, and we can identify, you can also look around. And I'm probably saying something here you already know, and if somebody said something you're interested in, I'd encourage you to seek that person out at lunch or at coffee or whatever it is, and explore this further. I found this is one of the real joys of and pluses of a place like this. Larry wants, I don't know if he wants, but Larry's going to have the last one.
your session has gotten me thinking about all kinds of things, and this discussion has as well. I think if we take the new believer seriously, though, we best ask hard questions about what you do with them if you do get them interested in the church, because their experience of their vivid religious experience is an experience outside the church.
Right.
All right?
Yeah.
Our tendency is to ecclesiasticize the laity.
Right.
You get them active in programs of the church, and that's how they somehow are supposed to express their faith. Well, that's just asking for trouble. Rather, as was pointed to in some of the comments, one ought to ask, where is the expression of their faith in that place where they've already had their religious experience? And that isn't by channeling them into programs of the church. That's by if it's an experience of someone in his or her own work as a lawyer in some movement, then somehow the church helps gives focus to that and grow from there, rather than electing them to a committee on church maintenance. I mean, we could just simply squelch the flame by ecclesiasticizing the laity.
There are Christians, new Christians, who still need milk.
There always will be.